Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to episode 84 of Histories of the Unexpected, the show in which we demonstrate how everything, absolutely everything, even the most unexpected of subjects, has a history, like sandals, lamps, or coal.
I want to do skin.
Ooh.
And scissors.
Okay.
Scissors about cutting up things.
I know. About, I know that.
No. Not in a dull way. In a deeply profound way.
Mm. Okay, let's do scissors.
Cutting up texts.
Putting them on the list.
Rearranging them and Bibles and
cool.
Religion and all that jazz. So, scissors,
yep.
Skin,
still
on our list.
Yep.
Brilliant. We'll be following the links in our minds as we come across them, explaining how those histories link together in unexpected ways. Who knew, for example, Sam, who knew that the history of soap is not just all about cleanliness. It's also about slipperiness. It's about advertising and art. It's about flattery and persuasion. It's about soft soaping somebody. Although the history of... Do you like that? Do you
yes.
like what I did there? Very clever. All that the history of stone is not just about castles. It's about power. It's about crime and punishment. It's also about childhood. Think about small boys with catapults.
Mm, it's about trade as well. How do you transport stone? One of the difficultest things to transport.
The difficult
ice and
it's
snow.
It's about hypocrisy. People in glass houses mustn't throw stones.
Very good.
And all that.
The man sitting opposite me is the General Secretary of the Historical Workers' Party of the past. It's
no.
Professor Extraordinaire of Early Modern British History at Plymouth University. It's James Daybell. Hello, James.
Hello, Sam. Hello, Sam. I've been trying to keep a theme going through these introductions to you, but...
My theme is going to be communist from now on.
Communist from now on.
Yeah.
Mine was sort of Roman.
Oh.
This week, you are the centurion of centuries past.
Very good.
You are the famous historical adventurer, Dr. Sam Willis. Hello, Sam.
Hello.
Are you well?
Yeah, I'm really good.
Good.
Thank you very much. Which is important, an important question to ask, because we are going to be talking today about accidents. Wow, what a great subject.
A brilliant subject.
How can accidents have a history?
Different from purposeful disasters.
Yes.
It's very different. So it's not about wars or terrorist attacks. It's about sort of, you know, things that happen by accident. How on earth can they have a history?
So it's one of these wonderful subjects that the more you think about it, the more you realise that it's actually fundamental to...
Everything.
Everything yes. that happens, but not only that, as historians, it's fundamental to the way we understand the past.
It's about discovering things by accident.
Yeah. And I think accidentally dropping out of pockets. And
yes.
accidents causing events to happen in the past, which we then discover by accident.
Yes.
It's a whole
happenstance.
History is a kind of crazy jumble of accidents.
The history of serendipity.
It is, isn't it? I love that word.
But you could also think about types of accidents. From sort of aviation, transport accidents, car accidents, amusement parks, cable transports, explosions, industrial accidents, medical accidents, smog.
Yeah.
All sorts of things. It's also about squirrels, which I'm going to talk to you about later on. It's about squirrels and tattoos.
I'd love to do the history of squirrels.
Yes.
You know, all I know, this is my junior pub knowledge, is that the grey squirrel is like some kind of horrible Japanese knotweed of the squirrel, basically. And it's been destroying all of the really pretty, nice English squirrels.
Red squirrels.
Yeah. It's not a Japanese grey squirrel, but if it was a knotweed, it would be Japanese knotweed. How am I doing here?
You do very well.
Thank you.
I'm just can't help laughing.
Okay,
but this is also a really, we're making light of it. It's a deeply important subject.
Something that I've come across in my work quite a lot.
Something I've come across in my work quite a lot. We've talked about it a little bit when we talked about the history of childhood. And we talked about how do you...
Oh, that was wonderful, wasn't it? We were talking about, how...
How do you reconstruct the history of childhood? Because we often have coroner's records that talk about unfortunate childhood deaths.
Yeah.
But what that allows you to do is sort of piece together all this sort of incidental information about childhood play and where they spend their lives and attitudes towards parents.
A kid throwing bricks in the air.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then it came down on his head.
Yeah. Don't throw bricks in the air, please.
No. Do not do this at home.
Not a good game. So accidents has a fairly interesting part of my own personal academic history.
Are you accident prone?
No.
Nor am I.
I am in my life and career, if you know what I mean, not physically.
Right. So things have happened accidentally to you.
Stuff happens accidentally all the time. Yeah. Mm. Not necessarily accidentally, but
good fortune.
Good fortune, yes. I suppose, and bad fortune. Mm. So I want to talk particularly about my career.
Do.
As an academic. So I'm having my hands here. My first ever published piece of work.
Mm.
You are?
May I see? May I read it?
Read the title.
Read the title. It's in the Mariner's Mirror, which is a brilliant naval history journal.
Maritime History, published by the Society for Nautical Research, which everyone should join. Please go and do that.
Volume 90, number 2, May 2004. 152 to 166. The High Life.
It's May 2004, Topman. 14 years ago to this month.
Ooh.
The new copy of the Mariner's Mirror has just come out.
Huh. The High Life, Topman in the 18th Century Navy by Sam Willis.
That's me. Good title.
Topmen, are they... I mean, I know nothing about this.
Right.
Are they up stuff and fall down?
So up stuff and fall down. Yeah, yep. Topmen
yep.
are the young, agile... boys who sailed on these great big warships like HMS Victory,
and
they climbed up the rigging and did the rigging stuff.
Right.
So I, before I did my PhD, which is on the 18th century Navy, I went to sea and I learned to sail these ships. So I replicas of them.
Yeah.
I gathered a kind of a very good first-hand understanding of what it's like to work aloft.
On a tall ship. Ships.
Yeah. And I then realised through reading a lot of 18th century background information, secondary sources, that there was a kind of a gap in the knowledge, basically. Mm. And I think being able to do history properly at this kind of level where you're trying to fill in gaps is very important to be able to see them first. And once you see them, then your whole kind of historical world opens up. And it seemed very clear that no one had actually written anything about the people who operated the sails and climbed up the rigging. And because of that, there was a great big misunderstanding about what it was actually like. And the main misunderstanding is that it was exceptionally dangerous and that you needed to have an enormous amount of skill to be able to do it. So there were lots of people arguing that the naval problems in certain periods was to do with an absence of skilled top men, an absence of people who had the time to train. So I wrote an article which explained that actually it was a lot easier than it looked. It doesn't need a great deal of training, but particularly it was to do the dangers of it. So there were historians writing about it. Ruptures and falls were common. It required courage and a constant renewal of initiative and daring. And even one suggested that it was life-threatening on a regular basis. And I did a bit of research and I argued and I explained that it wasn't like that. I explained all of the ways in which the captain could control the motion of the ship to make it less dangerous for the sailors aloft. I talked about climbing. I talked about historical accounts of climbing. I talked about them training and how they actually did it. And then one of the problems here is that there are very few surviving surgeons' accounts.
Right.
And surgeons' logs and surgeons' journals. But I found a handful of them. And they recorded the occasional fall from aloft, the occasional death from aloft. But many, many more, so were people dropping cannonballs on their feet, falling down hatchways and ladders, and other kind of normal accidents. So aboard HMS Edgar, 74-gun ship, in the 2 years between August 1797 and 1799, 11 falls were recorded, none of which...
were fatal.
...were from aloft.
Oh.
Seven of them were down hatchways and ladders. So this whole idea of people falling from aloft, or falls from aloft, was completely unsubstantiated. It was untrue. There were the occasional things, but if you think about the quantity of the sheer number of times people were sent aloft, and then you think about the number of people involved, it really, really sort of puts it into perspective. Here you are. Here's an extract from the log of the Alexander in 1761. At 4 p.m., handed mainsail. 7 p.m., took a reef in each topsail. 9 p.m., handed fore-to-gallant sail. 10 p.m., handed main-to-gallant sail. 2 a.m., set to gallant sail. 6 a.m., let the reefs out. And so on and so on and so on. And you could get as many as 80 men, sometimes 100, across the largest yard of a big sailing warship. So if you think about the sheer amount of people that are up there working aloft and the frequency with which they're aloft, having one fall, which may not be fatal from aloft, it worked out about one fall a year per ship.
Which is not.
It's not.
Statistically, that's not a lot.
No, and I found wonderful evidence for captains properly taking care. It makes sense. Why would you not do this? So you get a load of 15-year-old boys on your ship, you look after them, and you make sure they can climb safely. Really effective ways of training. They used to spread the main awning underneath the sails, so they would feel like they had a bit of a safety net. And then they would get them to go halfway up the lower bits, and then a bit higher, and then a bit higher. And what I liked about it is that once you realise the truth behind it, it's very logical and it makes perfect sense. Why would someone not train their young boys? Interesting.
So ships aren't that dangerous.
They are not that dangerous. Absolutely not that dangerous. All you need to climb aloft is a bit of your own bit of confidence. One of the most interesting things I found these orders to tell sailors to hold fast when they were hoisting and lowering the topsail yard. But the implication of being told to hold fast is that you could be quite happily up the rigging not holding fast. And the one thing, what do sailors need when they're working up aloft? They need their hands. By definition, your hands are free. So what they would do is they would brace their bodies in particular parts of the rigging, and there was rigging built and structured like a huge climbing frame to allow you to do that. Mm. So you'd brace your legs behind you, you'd brace your hips. It was all to do with your kind of core stability and your lower body strength, so that your hands were free, not for holding on, but so you could actually do the work that was required. You could hoist up the sails, you could tie up the gaskets, you could do everything. So that was a
So is there a sense that,
moment
in
my life?
That ship's captains were safety conscious?
Yeah, absolutely.
So this idea of health and safety isn't just a new invention.
And really interestingly, the what puts that into, I think, a clear light is that one of the most famous mutinies of the period, 1797, was a mutiny on board HMS Hermione. That was sparked off by the deaths of two sailors who fell from aloft, but they were forced to do so. They were forced to hurry back by a nasty captain to avoid them being beaten. And the whole fact that this was considered completely and utterly unfair caused one of the bloodiest, most severe mutinies in the Navy. I mean, the sailors self-policing and saying, actually, you can't do that. This is not the way that things work. But when you've got that many ships and that many men, you're always going to have bad apples, and it's always going to go slightly wrong. But it's just that our understanding of it was just being seen through the wrong end of the telescope, to use an nautical metaphor.
Excellent. I mean, I want to take that idea of health and safety back in time. People grumble about health and safety, and I think in the UK we've gone slightly silly about this, so much so that in order to take a group of students literally across the road to the local museum, you have to fill out a sort of detailed health and safety form.
How you plan to do it.
Maybe that, how exactly how you plan. Well, we plan to sort of, press the traffic light and stop and walk over and, watch the cars. Ridiculous. However, health and safety is a much earlier
it is a thing,
invention.
Isn't it? It's a really interesting historical thing.
Very interesting thing. And we have here 1573, Thomas Tusser's 500 points of good husbandry. Tusser was an English poet and farmer.
I was feeling quite smug and I was like, no, it's a very old thing. And I thought you were going to say 1873 in the factory.
No.
Like, no, 1570.
500 points of good husbandry as well for the champion or open country as also for the woodland or several mixed in every month with housewifery over and besides the book of housewifery. What he does in this is he spells out certain things that you need to do in order to be safe in everyday life. And this includes, for example, the very important tip that when standing in front of brakeless carts on icy slopes, you can stop them from going down. Right. You literally stand in front of it. Or
is that a good thing?
It's a good thing. You stand in front of them. So that you stop them sort of going away. So rather
hitting
than just
someone
leaving,
else.
Hitting somebody else.
Okay, right.
Or cart drivers should carry a bag of snails and crack them on the wheels to keep them lubricated.
Okay.
So snail slime. Farm workers were told to walk in a sort of staggered diagonal line when scything grass.
So they don't
otherwise,
scythe
you,
each
so
other.
So you basically don't sort of, you know, chop each other's limbs off. And there were also instructions about how, you know, if you were climbing up trees to bag crows,
right,
you know, exactly how you'd do it so that you didn't sort of fall to your death.
Interesting.
So there's an interesting sort of Tudor history of safety. But and this is where the squirrel comes in.
Mm-hmm.
Tufty Club. Were you ever a member of the Tufty Club?
No, I don't even know what that means.
My mother ran the local Tufty Club in Hornsey, in Yorkshire, in the late 70s, in this little seaside town that I lived in, which was an invention of ROSPA, the Royal Society for the Prevention of Accidents.
Right, never heard of
ROSPA. Yes, ROSPA. Founded at a public meeting in 1916, it was decided in London to elect a safety first council to tackle the, and I quote, alarming increase in traffic accidents and the direct connection therewith of the restricted street lighting, which has been necessitated by war conditions. And effectively, what happens, the motor car and accident, I mean, not the motor car, but sort of, you know, wartime conditions, more people, you know, needing to switch off lights, more traffic on the roads, horse and cart, the invention of the car, you need a body to basically police all this, come up with laws and rules in order to make people secure and safe. And there is a very interesting history of the heritage of ROSPA. If you go to their website, you can find all of this out, which includes pedestrians facing oncoming traffic. You know, this idea when you're wandering down country lanes that you walk on the side of traffic that is coming into you. So when you're going around corners, you have to swap over. But that became a rule by ROSPA. The Highway Code, the invention of the Highway Code in 1924 and the government version in 1931. The curb drill for children. And of course, cycling proficiency scheme, safety standards for fire guards. You know, and things like the drink driving campaign, which does away with that sort of, you know, one for the road.
Safety for life at sea.
Safety for life at sea. But the Tufty Club.
Right.
The Tufty Club was, you know, was absolutely outstanding.
Why is it called the Tufty Club? I don't understand
this. Tufty was this little squirrel.
Oh, okay.
And Tufty, so it was a series of stories that enabled you, children, to learn about road safety. So Tufty and his friend.
He doesn't want to get squashed.
So Tufty Flufftail was born in 1953, was the creation of the late Elsie Mills MBE. And it was a series of stories that introduced the rules and regulations of crossing the road for children. It was earlier than that Stop, Look and Listen campaign. Tufty was joined in his adventures by his friends Minnie the Mole and Naughty Willy Weasel. Willy Weasel was almost always the one who'd be sort of rushing to cross over. Mrs. Owl the teacher and Policeman Badger, who always popped up in the nick of time. Founded in 1953, but by 1961, the Tufty Club was set up as a nationwide network of local groups. And at its peak, there were almost 25,000 registered Tufty Clubs, you know, that basically, you know, trained children to cross the road. And there's a, on the ROSPA website, there are a series of messages left for Tufty. And among them, my favourite message for, and this, when you remember that this is literally a cartoon character squirrel. Good morning. I was a member of the Tufty Club in the early 60s in Milngavie, just outside Glasgow. I've been compiling a tattooed memory sleeve, and today I had our little friend added. Regards, David. Another of my favourites.
What's a tattooed memory sleeve?
He's
literally tattooing sleeves on his arms. Of memories.
So your arm here.
Yes, I understand.
Is tattooed with particular tattoos that bring back memories
for you.
That have associations. I had my hair cut by a very nice hairdresser, mm-hmm. Jeff Goodwin's, in Exeter. And Craig, I think it was, had tattoos all over his arm.
Were they memory sleeve? They were memory sleeve
tattoos.
Amazing.
Yes. Another favourite is, hello, Tufty. Well, it's been a long time. Do you remember me? You taught me how to cross the road when I was 15. You were my hero when I was growing up. Sometimes when the road is very busy, I think to myself, how would Tufty cross this road? And it helps me to get... Sam, could you read this? It's that one there.
I can't read it. I'm sorry. I just got the giggles.
It helps me to get over it safely. I used to be a member of your club. I was so proud. I put it on my CV and everything when I left school. Please could you send me details of how I could join again, as I think my membership has expired. Also, do you sell cuddly tufties? I'd love to put one on my checkout in the supermarket I work in. Oh,
bless.
I like
That's
that.
Very
million.
Sweet.
That is lovely, isn't it?
Isn't that lovely? So it is in fact all about squirrels.
It is all about squirrels. It's all about chalk as well.
Tell me about chalk.
It's a bit sadder, this story. Two similar sad stories.
We don't like sad, do we?
Well, I don't know. It kind of came to mind when I was in China last week, and I went to the Tonglushan copper mine, which is a huge open pit copper mine, and they.
Oh, God, dunks, I can imagine.
Anyway, they've been digging copper there for 3,000 years. And buried underneath the slag is a completely perfect, immaculately preserved 2,000-year-old copper mine. Amazingly clever. On three levels, they dug tunnels to get in, they dug tunnels to get out, they dug tunnels to get water from underground streams up for the smelting process. They dug more tunnels to help them deal with flooding. Amazing. But looking at it and exploring those tunnels really made me think about mining safety, which also raises the interesting question of civilian gallantry medals because of mining disasters.
Oh, yes.
So I'm going to talk a bit about this. One of the
horrific
most
accidents.
Striking stories. If you don't know, if you've got 10 minutes spare, Google the Edward Medal because it is a medal. It's like the Victoria Cross, but it's for civilians. And the stories that survived, there are not a lot of them, but are absolutely astonishing. And one of them, it's to do with the Wellington Pit disaster in Whitehaven, Cumbria in 1910. There was a fire, there was a terrific explosion, and there was some suggestion that not all of the men down the mine had died. So everyone else piled in to the roaring flames to go and get as many of these people out as they could. But even though they managed to get seven of the original shift of 143 of them. Mm. So an enormous amount of men died. Local community was transformed. 85 women were widowed. 260 children lost their fathers. But 64 men were awarded the Edward Medal for this. And I just wanted to read out this quote from the London Gazette. Right through the night and all the next day, rescue parties were at work trying to reach the workings where the missing men were entombed. But it was extremely difficult, the atmosphere dense. Some of the timbering in the mine was on fire. So timbering is what holds up the tunnels.
Mine.
The only means of ventilating the portion of the pit where the men were trapped was entirely cut off. At the pit head, there were near heart-rending scenes. Women with children in pain and anxiety waited for news of their loved ones. Many of them stayed at the pit head all night and the whole of the following day, refusing to leave for rest or refreshment. And a number collapsed, worn out by their vigil. Now, when I'd say I'd talk about chalk, was one of the interesting things is that when they actually managed to get the fire under control and they went back in, they realised that they were right, and a number of people had survived the initial explosion. They didn't go on to survive the subsequent fire, but they'd written messages on the walls in chalk for their loved ones, which were actually the Grenfell Tower's been in the news a lot recently with the public inquiry, and there have been harrowing stories of people leaving messages on phones. You know, it also happened in the Twin Towers, but
yes, exactly,
here it was to do with chalk and to do with this terrible explosion. But that in turn reminded me of the Kursk, the Russian nuclear sub, which suffered an explosion. One of their torpedoes had not been maintained properly. It's very toxic fuel came through, exploded, caused another explosion. But a number of those sailors survived the initial explosion. They were not saved in the end because the Russians would for a number of reasons didn't send the rescue party as early as they could. But when they finally raised the submarine, there were similar to the Wellington pit, they found letters written by the people who were there
to loved ones.
Written to loved ones. It's too dark here to write, but I'll try to feel. It looks like we have no chance. 10-20%. We'll hope that someone will read this. Here is the list of those present from the other sections who are now in the ninth section and will try to escape. Hello to everybody. Don't despair. And that was from Captain Dmitry Kolesnikov. Another one. If you are reading this note, it means I'm dead, but your lives will carry on. And I ask that my son becomes a true man like I used to be. And that was senior midshipman Andrei Borisov. So,
accidents.
Horrific, yep. horrific accidents.
And one of the best projects I've seen recently about accidents is a social and economic history project coming out of Oxford University, run by Stephen Gunn at Merton, and it's the Everyday Life and Fatal Hazard in 16th Century England project. I've known Steve for many, many years. He's a brilliant Tudor historian, works on one of the leading experts on Henry VII, and this is his new project, and he's been doing it for the last 5 or 6 years, and it is a phenomenal project. It is based on 9,000 records, coroner's inquests. So coroners would be called in when there was an unnatural or violent death. So something needed to be... So somebody didn't sort of die in bed of natural causes, but something or other happened. And so what you have is this extraordinary snapshot of daily life. And what's interesting about this is that you can look at this as a way of looking at risk in Tudor society. You can look at it in terms of the kind of activities that people were in. You know, you can look at it and just looking at the kinds of things that were dangerous, but also all the incidental details that are contained in this allow us to see so much sort of in a very sort of rich way life in Tudor England. What is extraordinary about it, though, is the way in which it tells us, you know, the kinds of deaths that were quite common throughout this period. One of the most common and dangerous activities was archery.
Mm.
And there are all sorts of descriptions of people, you know, not only people who manage to sort of shoot themselves while they have their bow and arrow, but also people who are spectators or nearby who get shot.
Yeah.
Summer is one of the most dangerous times of the year. Because, of course, everyone is outside, they're out in the fields, they're collecting hay and all sorts of harvesting and all sorts of things.
Mm.
But it's the most extraordinary.
Yeah, and I think there'll be some wonderful stuff being published.
Yes.
Out of that research.
Definitely.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for listening, everyone. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review on iTunes. You subscribe to the podcast. Tell all your friends. We're on Twitter. You can follow me at Dr. Sam Willis.
And you can follow me at James Daybell. And you can follow us on at Unexpected Pod. We are truly proud to be part of the excellent History Hit Network, home of Dan Snow's History Hit and other monumentally brilliant shows.
And check out our website, historiesoftheunexpected.com. It's got information about books. It's got information about our live shows. And we hope to see you soon. Come along. All right then, bye.
Bye.